from that for one time only, and we're going to talk about something that's very special and dear to me and all of us, probably, hopefully, definitely, which is the Earth. We're going to talk a little bit about creation. If you noticed in the worship, there's a lot of themes about Earth, Moon, Sun. So we're going to be talking about those kind of earthly things and our relation to it and the reconciliation of humanity and Earth. The purpose of all this is that soon, Carl kind of announced we're starting Sunday school again. And once we get through having breakfast with dead people, then we're going to start teaching through Genesis. And that has a lot to do with creation. This is to get us started and ready and to give us a framework for how to be thinking about this human-earth relationship. We usually talk about like a human-to-human relationship or a human-to-God relationship, but now I want to introduce or just recognize the earth as the third dimension in that relationship of God, earth, humanity. If you want to go ahead, we're going to start in Exodus 5. We're going to be going through a lot of scripture. Just this is steeped in scripture. So if you don't have a Bible, do that. Also, if you want to take notes on that piece of paper, if you have a pen, that would be beneficial because, as I said, this is kind of like an introduction to a framework on how to view our relationship with the earth. So this theme will be coming up again and again, and this is to get us started on that road to reconciliation. So basically what I'll be introducing is not just a topic, but it's an entire philosophy on how to live. It'll be coming from a biblical perspective, a postmodern perspective, and then also an agrarian perspective, which is me, my perspective. Basically, just to start off so you know where we're going, there's four goals that I would like for us as a community here today to realize. First, we're just going to want to discover a new lens through which to view the Bible. And what I'm talking about today and the scriptures that I'm using have earth themes, but I could have picked an entirely new set of scripture and still come out with the same message. Just the Bible is steeped in this, in talk about the earth and agriculture, and like so much has to do with those things. And so to have an understanding of agriculture and environmental care, that's going to help you in reading any part of the Bible and help give you another new perspective along with your reading of the Bible. Secondly, we're going to realize that we're a part of a story that God is telling. We're part of this biblical story, and we're going to look to see what our place in that is, where we have come from and where we're going. Thirdly, we're going to look very closely at the connectivity of the earth with economics, with social justice, and that all these things are interconnected. There's no, nothing sectioned off and by itself. Like, everything relates to something else. So that when the earth is healthy, humans are healthy, and the economy is healthy, and how all those things work together. And most importantly, at the end, I'll be proposing a new land ethic, which is exactly what it sounds like, ethics for how to treat this land as Christians and as humans. so my goal ultimately is nothing short than an introduction of an entirely new mindset on how to view the earth and each other. So basically first, I want to set up the story that we're in. We all know that the biblical story starts in a garden, and we're placed into that garden just through Genesis 1 and 3. God places us in a perfect relationship where all things are harmonious, and God's perfect presence is just teeming and just so available in that place. And then in Genesis 3, that perfect harmony is broken. And then at the end of the Bible, God restores all these things again. And we move from a garden into what Revelation 21 and 22 calls a city. And in the city, there's a river that goes right through the middle of it. There is, again, a tree of knowledge of all things good and evil. So it's much like the garden. It's kind of set up like it, but now we've progressed and we're in a city. And so what we are is we're in the middle of the garden and the city. And in the city, all things are reconciled, and God's presence is once again here on earth. And so we're in this broken, kind of dysfunctional society, stumbling to get back to the garden. So that's where we are. Today we're going to talk about what it means to be in the middle in the story and how we can navigate through it. Okay, so Exodus 5. You guys are probably way ahead of me because I'm not there yet. Basically, we know this story. The Hebrews are in Egypt, and they are slaves. And God is not down with that. And he wants to bring people out of it and show a new reality. And so what we're going to enter into is that story where people are being brought out of Egypt. We'll start in verse 4. But the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why are you taking the people away from their work? Get to the laborers. Pharaoh continued, now they are more numerous than the people of this land, and yet you want them to stop working. That same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people, as well as their supervisors, you shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves, but you shall require of them the same quantity of bricks as they have made previously. Do not diminish it, for they are lazy. That is why they cry, let us go and offer sacrifice to a god. Let heavier work be laid on them, then they will labor at it and pay no attention to deceptive words. So the taskmasters and the supervisors of the people went out and said to everyone, thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go and get straw yourselves, wherever you can find it, and work, and the work will not be lessened in the least. So people scattered throughout the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw. The taskmasters were urgent, saying, complete your work, the same daily assignments as you were given, as when you were given straw. And the supervisors of the Israelites, whom the Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, why did you not finish the required quantity of bricks yesterday and today as you did before? So what I want to point towards is that this society might be kind of familiar to us. Egypt was the start or one of the first industrial societies. Their requiring of their slaves, which just happened to be the Hebrews, that they work harder and harder with no rest. in this, humans are basically treated as machines. There's no respect towards their humanity, but their only purpose is to produce and nothing more. And we will see that for God's people is essential to rest. And in this, there is no rest. And so God is bringing them out so they can be fully human. The point of leaving Egypt is that humans were becoming not what they were supposed to be. And so God is taking them back to give them a new reality. We can kind of see that in this kind of slavery, that it's a lot like how we treat our immigrants and corporate workers throughout the world. So it's not that this story of the Exodus happened and that people were in slavery, but that is still happening. That this story is very much alive, and we can see it in our own lives and in others around us, that sometimes we're forced to be something other than human, and we're forced to produce for whatever the reason, and that there's no room for rest, and that God is calling us out of that. So now, let's move forward in the story and turn to Numbers 11. So now God has done whatever it has taken to get the people out. You know, the 10 plagues, like just sent out the sickness throughout the land. And then finally the people were able to go. And so now they're in the wilderness part of the story. They have not yet a home. They're in limbo between their old reality and coming up to something new. And God is preparing them for that, but this is what is happening. Verse 1, now when the people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes, the Lord heard it, and his anger was kindled. So they're complaining, like they were brought out of slavery, and now they complain because they did not know any other way to live. Right now they're facing a food scarcity, so we're going to talk about that. Verse 4, the rabble among them had a strong craving, and the Israelites also wept again and said, if only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we used to eat in Egypt for nothing, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our strength is dried up, and there is nothing at all but this manna to look at. Now the manna was like coriander seed, and its color was the color of gum resin. And the people went around and gathered it, ground it in mills, and beat it in mortars, then boiled it in pots and made cakes of it. And the taste of it was like the taste of cakes baked with oil. When the dew fell on the camp in the night, the manna would fall with it. So what is happening is that God is trying to be the sole provider for this people's well-being and for their survival. But they are used to getting rations of food that frankly sound pretty good at this point. They're along the Nile River, so there's a great availability of fish, and Egypt had lots of growing vegetables, and now they have none of that. There's no cultivation of the land, and so God is providing, and these people are saying, this is not good enough. And so this manna that is falling from the sky is not only a gift, but it's also a test. It's God is asking, will this be enough for you? And right now, they're saying no. The purpose of this being out in the wilderness is is that God is trying to form them into a new humanity. He's trying to give them a new identity, not one of slaves of this big empire, but that of a community focused towards serving God. And this is difficult. This is a difficult concept for them to grasp. Because they have no knowledge, there's this confusion of what's going to be next. And so they want to go back. So they are trying. God is trying to give them a new mindset that God will provide and not them. They cannot provide ultimately for themselves. Also, God is preparing them for what it will be like to have a new land. And it is evident that that they're not only, we always hear that they're given a land, but it's more than a land, it's a way to use the land and how to live in the land. So what we find a lot in this Exodus story is God is giving them a way to deal with each other and a way to deal with the earth. So a lot of what is going on in the Bible at this part of the story is commandments that are environmentally friendly. God is teaching them how to take care of the earth so that when they get there, they do not destroy it. Because they have to have an understanding of their place. Egypt was a very fertile place, and agriculture was just vibrant there. But in the land of Canaan, it's not as secure. The land is a narrow, hilly, dry place. And so for them to survive, there's no room for air, such as too much use of water. They have to preserve everything that they have. They have to be careful of how they treat the hills, or otherwise erosion will happen. And so, and also if they work it too hard, they will work themselves too hard, and they will be too weary to enjoy anything. So an understanding of place is so essential for humanity. So for us, it's very important for us to understand our place. Anderson. Anderson is, when you drive in, you're greeted by this big $1 million chocolate bunny. And then you come in, and for most of the people in this town, a casino is their greatest source of hope. It's kind of a sad place. All things green have been turned gray. There's this hope that industry will be brought back once again, and that this place will be a vibrant place of many factories and stuff. And so there's this hope of bringing in new companies, and the mayor is flying all over the world in order to bring in these companies. That's not a thing against the mayor. Like, I don't know that much to say that. But like, that is what these post-industrial societies are doing. They're trying to bring in companies like Nestle, which happens to be one of the most, it's one of the top desecrators of the earth on this planet, and it's right here, and it was supposed to be our hope of finding new jobs, but the way that they get their, Nestle has a water thing, and that's mostly what this Nestle company does. And the way that they get that water is depleting the water source off of this earth. Where they get their chocolate, like, it's not good. And this, And this is right here. And this is supposed to be our town's hope of finding new jobs. But really, when this company came in, it brought in a lot of its own employees and really only created a few hundred jobs. And the city gave it so many breaks just in order to get it here that it's not really benefiting this community at all. So we're living in this post-industrial society, but there's this movement to go back. And that won't ever happen. So there's this false hope that we're moving into this new future, and it's kind of moving into like this kind of service economy, and all things are they'll never be the same again. And that is the place that we find ourselves. We're largely college students and community members living here, and we have to understand our place. But we also have to understand our place as humans. What was our original purpose, going back to Genesis? And what is our future in Revelation? A lot of times, a place becomes a character in a story. Like, just think of like Woody Allen movies. Like, New York City is itself, a lot of times, a character in its own right. And place becomes a part of our identity. I know for myself, just going to college here, Anderson will always be a part of who I am. And that will never change. And it's a part of all of us. It has shaped us in some way. Just the vibe of this place and our relationship with it has formed us as who we are as human beings. And so to understand that a place is a part of who you are is essential to being a human. And so we're in this summer period as a community, and soon students will be back for fall session. And especially new students, we need to have and we need to give as a community, as a church body, an understanding of this place to them, and to help them and help ourselves realize that this place is a part of us and we have something to do with its future. Some people have committed a big chunk of their lives to living here and serving it to make it better just by their presence. And a lot of what Mercy House internships have been about that. Like, we find ourselves, it almost seems, strategically placed in this, and we all know this, this incredibly poor area. And isn't it ironic that, I mean, most of us are going to college, we're pretty affluent. And we bring our education and our backgrounds into this place, and we can have a significant impact. And so we need to understand where we are in order to affect this place positively. So we need to have a proper relationship with all else, with every other part of humanity and this earth. So let's turn to Leviticus 25 to kind of help us understand that proper relationship. In verse 23, the land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. With me you are but aliens and tenants. Throughout the land that you hold, you shall provide for the redemption of the land. This is the main point of my whole message. And that is that the earth is God's, and it is not ours. It is not ours. Here, God is talking about land not being sold as a product. That there is an intrinsic sacred value to land, and that it should not be sold. And so what happens in this Israelite community is that they pass it down from family, within a family on down. And so that it never should ever change hands in ownership through payment. And so, yes, we must understand that our role is to help in the redemption of the land with God. So we must understand that this land is sacred and that it is also not ours. And we are just sojourners on this earth, part of some plan that God has, and that we are an extension of what God is trying to do with the reconciliation of this earth. And now, this comes from a certain kind of theology. This is a theology that God will make all things new here and that heaven will come down to earth. And it's not based in a theology that many of us may have grown up with, that we are just here for a limited amount of time, which is true, but that because of that, we don't need to care about where we are because God is going to wreck it and we are going to leave here and go someplace else. The theology that I'm talking about is that we're staying here and that God is making this place new. We're not going somewhere else. And so we need to redeem this place and not have a lack of concern for this place because we're going somewhere else. We need to have an extreme amount of concern for this place. I forgot to mention this, but I think that this is really interesting. Back in Genesis, the word for man, but human, you know, to be correct in our speaking, is Adam. That's the Hebrew word. And the word for land in Hebrew is Adama. And so both the words for humanity and for the land comes from the same root word. And the reason for this is that humans were given their name because their color looks a lot like that of the land. We have this, all different, like the land has many different colors. It can be reddish, brownish, whatever. And humans were given their name because of their similarities with the earth. So now this is going to be my main text, Job 38, and through chapter 40. And this might seem like a weird choice for an environmental message, but I think you'll come to see the point here. Basically, we know the story of Job. Job has fallen on a little bit of bad luck, and he's asking all these questions like, why, God, did you? Why did you do this? Why have you inflicted so much pain upon me? And friends come over and they try to help him out. And they just get done with that conversation. And now a fifth voice enters into the narrative. And that is God. And now God is going to explain in his own way why Job has gone through this. And so 38:1, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Skip down to verse 4. He is speaking here. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk, or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy? Or who shut in the sea with doors and when it burst out from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band and prescribed bounds for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far you shall come and no further, and here shall you shall your proud waves be stopped? Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place so that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? It is changed like clay under the seal and has dyed like a garment. Light is withheld from the wicked and their uplifted arm is broken. Have you entered into the spring of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of the deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanses of the earth? Declare, if you know all this, where in the way of to the dwelling of light, and where is the place of darkness, that you may take it to its territory, that you may discern the paths to its home. Surely you know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. So this is God being sarcastic. Job, you're so great. You're so old. Like, he's being sarcastic with him, obviously, which is kind of funny that God is sarcastic. God is putting Job into his place as a human, and that surely, Job, you know all these things that I know. Surely you know. And which he doesn't. And so through that way of talking to him, he makes Job realize how little his concerns actually are, even though his pain is so great. Let's go down to chapter 39. Here God starts to talk about animals. And he's talking to Job still. Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of deer? And here comes verse 5, my favorite verse of the Bible. Who has let the wild ass go free? Who has loosened the bonds of the swift ass? skip down to verse 13. The ostrich's wings flap wildly, though its pinions lack plumage. For it leaves its eggs to the earth and lets them be warmed on the ground. Forgetting that we're talking about ostrich now. We're done with the wild ass. So the ostrich forgets that it has laid egg, and a foot may crush them, and that a wild animal may trample upon them. It deals cruelly with its young as if they were not its own. Though its labor should be in vain, yet it has no fear, because God has made it forget wisdom and given it no share in understanding. When it spreads its plumes aloft, it laughs at the horse and the rider. Let's go to chapter 40, verse 15. Look at the behemoth. A behemoth is probably like an elephant or a rhino here, which I made just as I made you. It eats like an ox, and its strength is in its loins, and its power in the muscles of its belly. It makes its tail swift like a cedar, and its sinews of the thighs are knit together. Its bones are tubes of bronze, and its limbs are like bars of iron. Down to 41, verse 1. Can you draw out the Leviathan, which is probably like an alligator, with a fish hook? So can you fish a crocodile? Like, can you? Or press down its tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in its nose or pierce its jaw with a hook? Will it make any supplications to you? Will it speak soft words to you? Go down to verse 12. I will not keep silent concerning its limbs. Okay, so what God is doing is he's talking and he's going on and on about animals, his creation. Like, have you seen the ostrich try to fly? Like, have you seen that? It can't, but it's trying and it's hilarious. And what's the point to that? There's no point. It's just pleasurable to me to watch the ostrich try to fly. And what is the point of the behemoth? It's just big and strong, and I love it. And what's the point of an alligator. I don't know. It's just pretty intense looking, you know? And God is saying, I will not be silent about my creation. You will notice here that for God, there is a big lack of pragmatism. There is no point to all this stuff. There's no practical, applicable use to these things. It's just that they exist. And so what's the point exactly? There's no point but pleasure, that these things bring God pleasure. And he's saying to Job, look at these things. Consider the ostrich trying to fly. Just look at that. Come on, like, that's hilarious. Look at that, Job. What's your pain about? You know? I will not keep silent. God wants to go on and on talking about just the intrinsic beauty of what he has created. So we must understand that we serve a God of pleasure, not of production. And it is these things, these animals, plants along with it, that are in danger because we do not treat them as if they are valuable just in their own right because they exist. We treat everything as what its use could be for us. And if it does not have a use for us, it becomes extinct. We need to understand, as God does, just how much things that have no point can bring pleasure. Like, for my birthday, I got a bonsai tree. And what is the point of a bonsai tree? It's this miniature tree. But to me, it brings a lot of joy just to look at this small little tree, like that I can sit on my desk and feel like I'm out in a forest. You know, like it just brings me joy, and there's no other point to it than that. It just brings me pleasure, and that's it. And that's it. So this has kind of been my teaching section, and we're going to move to an application section of how to apply this philosophy here. And we've touched on that a little bit, but we're going to go into a very deep depth on it. So first, to kind of sum up everything that I'm talking about, I ran across this poem that is beautiful, and it says exactly what I want to say, and I could just read that poem and make no points. But yes, to me, this poem is talking about exactly what I've been trying to say. And so we enter into it in the second stanza. It's by Wendell Berry, and it's called The Mad Farmer Liberation Front. And he says, so friends, and you can read along with me, silently, you don't have to. This isn't like scripture. Every day do something that won't compute. Love the Lord, love the world, work for nothing. Take all that you have and be poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Ask the questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant and that you will not live to harvest. Put your faith in the 2 inches of humus that will build under the trees every 1,000 years. Expect the end of the world and laugh. Laughter is immeasurable. Be joyful, even though you have considered all the facts. Go with your love to the fields. Lie easy in the shade. Rest your head in her lap. Swear allegiance to what is nighest, your thoughts. As soon as the generals and the politicos can predict the motions of your mind, lose it. Leave it as a sign to mark the false trail, the way you didn't go. Be like the fox, who makes more tracks than necessary, some in the wrong direction. Practice resurrection. So now we're going to talk a little bit about economy. And that we're all very aware that things are not in the best shape. I want to kind of diagnose what the problem is. We hear about all these corruption within these big corporations, and that they're using taxpayer money to go on vacations and use these huge and use taxpayer money for their hotel bills, and then this all crashed, and so we hear all these stories about bailout and the government now owning GM, and we hear these things, but what is really wrong? And that's what I want to talk about. There are three things. Three foundations of an economic crisis. And since we live in that, I would like to discuss these three foundations. And the first thing that is wrong is a value that our society holds of autonomy, that is independence, that we can do everything on our own. And there's a biblical precedence to this, so let's turn to Deuteronomy 8. This is back again to the Exodus story that we are becoming familiar with. We're going to start at verse 2. Remember the long way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness in order to humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commandments. He humbled you by letting you hunger, then by feeding you with manna, with which you nor your ancestors were acquainted, in order to make you understand that one does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Skip down to verse 7. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land with flowing streams and springs and underground water welling up in the valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey, a land where you may eat bread without scarcity, where you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and from whose hills you may mine copper. You shall eat your fill and bless the Lord your God for the good land that he has given you. Take care that you do not forget the Lord your God by failing to keep his commandments, his ordinances, and his statutes, which I am commanding to you today. When you have eaten your fill and you have built fine houses and live in them, and when your herds and flocks have multiplied and your silver and gold has also multiplied and all that you have is multiplied, then do not exalt yourself, forgetting the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, who led you through great and terrible wilderness and arid wasteland with poisonous snakes and scorpions. He made water flow for you from flint rock and fed you in the wilderness with manna that your ancestors did not know, to humble you and to test you, and in the end, to do you good. Do not say to yourself, my power and the might of my own hands have given me this wealth, but remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the power to produce wealth. So here, God is expecting that the land that the people are going to is going to become their home. And when it becomes their home, how are they going to treat it? How are they going to think of themselves when they have a nice house and when they have their agricultural system set back up? Are they going to give the glory to God or to themselves? And the problem with our society, our culture, is that we think that everything good that has happened is because of our own doing, our own invention. That's the dominant culture. Not every culture. And so what has happened in this economic crisis is that everyone is out for themselves, and everyone thinks that they can go out and do it alone. This also relates to the environmental message. A huge danger of being environmentally friendly and moving in that direction is the idea of becoming self-sufficient, that you can do it all on your own, that you can go off the grid, and that you can produce everything that you need for yourself. Sounds all well and good, but it's isolating. Like, if you do that by yourself, you're going to be alone, and you're not going to be connected with the real earth. And so it is important that we have a communal sufficiency, that we as a community are sufficient with the help of all, with everyone else, that we cannot do it alone, that I depend on someone else to do this while I'm doing this good work, you are doing something else, and that we both need to exchange that so that we can live together, so that we can live in connection with each other and with the earth. And so we cannot do it alone. We cannot do it alone. The second foundation of an economic crisis is anxiety. Let's turn to Leviticus 26, 36. Here we're entering into a story, and I won't really set it up, but and it says, "And as for those of you who survive, I will send faintness into their hearts in the lands of their enemies. The sound of a driven leaf shall put them to flight, and they shall flee as one flees from the sword, and they shall fall though no one pursues. They shall stumble over one another as if to escape a sword, though no one pursues them and your enemies. And your enemies shall have no power to stand against you." So what is happening is, like, the sound of a leaf falling sets off these people that are being talked about into panic. And they are running as though they're being chased, as if they're in danger, but there is no danger. Our anxiety is basically built, and we've heard this term, and I don't know if this is entirely correct, but sometimes we feel like we're in a rat race, that we're running towards this cheese, and we're going through all these tunnels and mazes, and we don't know why, and yet there's an extreme anxiety that we just need to get to the cheese. And we're just thinking about that, and that anxiety takes over. And that kind of anxiety has taken over in this society. It is that it's largely based in the understanding that on this earth, there's a scarcity of things, of resources. And when there's a scarcity, you have to get what you can in order to survive. And this is fundamentally based in a wrong kind of worldview about this earth. I would propose that we need to have an understanding of abundance and not of scarcity. That through God, that there's abundance of all things that we need, and that we do not need to take from others in order to get it cheaper and to get all these things that we think we need at the oppression of someone else, and that we need to understand that there is so much for everyone to have. And so this means, very practically, that we have to own less and that we have to desire less. Unless, basically what will happen is that the things that we own will come to own us. And that is been happening in this culture, and we need to let go of those desires in order that there is enough for everyone. Autonomy, anxiety, and lastly, greed. we see the greed in so much of what's going on today, that it's just so evident that I don't think I need to go into it too much. But let's look at Luke 12 for the biblical precedence of this idea. Starting at verse 13. Someone in the crowd said to him, Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Friend, who set me to be a judge or an arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care, be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." Then Jesus told them a parable. The land of a rich man produced abundantly. And he thought to himself, "What should I do? For I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to them, 'You fool, this very night your life is being demanded of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be?' So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich towards God." And so this is the idea of greed, that our barns are not big enough and that we need bigger ones, and that we're going to store everything we have in these bigger barns, and then we're going to relax and we're going to just become lazy and quit working, and we're not going to share the abundance with others, and we're just going to store it for ourselves. We can see this theme throughout our society. Picking back up, Jesus now starts to talk about an alternative to this economy of greed. He said to his disciples, "Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, or about your body, what you will wear. Your life is more than food, and the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens. They neither sow nor reap. They have neither storehouse or barn, and yet God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than the birds? And can any of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your span of life? If then you are not able to worry about the rest, if you're not able to do so small a thing as that, why do you worry about the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow, how they neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not clothed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, you of little faith? And do not keep striving for what you are to eat and what you are to drink. And do not keep worrying, for it is the nations of the world that strive after all these things. And your Father knows that you need them. Instead, strive for his kingdom, and all these things will be given to you as well." Jesus here is talking about a society of abundance where there's no need for greed and there's no desire, there's no need to have a desire for things because God is taking care of us. How familiar does this sound to the wilderness narrative? That God is trying to provide and that we cannot do it ourselves. I would like to draw the connection of our current situation with that of Egypt. The Egyptian Empire dealt with a lot of the same issues that we are currently dealing with. And God is proposing an alternative, subversive way to live. An entirely new way that swims upstream and that does not follow the accepted truths of this society. And that God is shaping us into a new humanity. And so it is when things are taken away from us, it is when we hit rock bottom and when we have nothing, that our identities are formed. Just as in the wilderness, everything was taken from the Israelites everything, and they complained, and they wished that they could be back in slavery again, where at least they knew that they were going to have food. But I'm telling you, things are being taken away from us today. And we need to let go so that God can form us into a new identity, so that we can be properly related with God and with earth, and so that there is no disproportion of resources, and that we all only take what we need. And this is part of the new humanity. God is trying to make us fully human again. This is the renewal of all things. This is heaven being brought back to earth. If we practice these values of generosity and being a good neighbor and putting others before ourselves, that is what brings heaven to earth. And so we need to live as a church and as a community and as individuals that are connected to all of this as insurrectionists. An insurrectionist is someone who lives as though a revolution has already occurred, though it has not yet happened. So we are looking for this revolution of all things, and that is heaven to earth. That is the revolution, and that's the only revolution. And so we need to live as Christians and as humans, as insurrectionists, waiting and living as if the revolution has occurred. So this all relates to a recent trend that we all know well, this going green thing. And the danger of this is that it is a trend. It is a movement, and all trends and almost all movements end. And we hear it all, and then we forget. And so the principles of what has been happening, this awareness that the earth is not in good shape and that we are responsible for it, and that we're also responsible for its renewal and for its care, these need to be a part of our life, not just some abstract philosophy, going green, let's recycle, let's do all that stuff. I mean, this just needs to be ingrained in who we are as humans. And that's it. Why do we recycle? Why wouldn't we? There's a danger in this going green because a main point of it is that it will save money. Businesses are encouraged to go green. Our university is going green because it can save money. True, but we need to go green even if it costs us money, even if it takes away, because the earth is at stake. And we need to understand this, the sacred value of the earth as more, the earth is more than a product through which it can save us money. It just is a beautiful creation, and we must take care of it for no other reason that it brings us joy and it brings us pleasure. And so we must become a part of a resistance towards the things of this earth. In our corporate-driven society, ambiguity reigns. There's this don't ask, don't tell policy. As long as you don't know what is really going on and where your stuff comes from, you have no guilt. But once you start to know where things come from and you start to see that it is not good, that is when advocacy pops up. And so what we need to do as insurrectionists and as resistors to the way of this world is that we need to cut through the degrees of ambiguity. We need to start to understand where our clothes come from. We need to start to understand where our food comes from. Like consider a banana. Like, it has nothing but a label of what business it comes from. Chiquita, Dole, whatever. Maybe if it's organic, it's wrapped in this sticker that goes all the way across the bananas and makes it really hard to get the bananas out. But we have no idea, by buying that thing, where the heck it comes from and how it got to us and how it was produced. And if we found out where things such as bananas, for example, come from, it should terrify us at what is happening to get those things to us cheaper. If you notice how cheap bananas are, it's not a fair price. People are being oppressed because of things such as a banana. And so we need to become aware. We cannot accept the ambiguity of our culture. We must research, we must find out, we must find our place. We need to commit to this cause. I would argue that our culture, as it dominantly exists, is looking for people to commit to a cause. And our cause requires sacrifice. This will not bring you a comfy living to live as if the reconciliation of the earth depends on us. It won't be an easy road. We will always, if we commit to it, be swimming upstream and against the dominant forces. Consider Moses. He was given this calling to bring these people out of a place of bondage and into someplace new, where a new humanity could be exercised and realized. But Moses did not live to see it. Such as in the poem, Wendell Berry talks about planting sequoias. How long does a sequoia take to grow? If we plant it, we won't see it to bring benefit to resourceful benefit to us. We must plant things that we will not see the end of, and we must build towards things that we will not see harvest. This cause that we are committing to, we will not see the end of it, and we must pass it down to our next generation. There must be a connection from us on down. We have been handed a certain set of problems, a certain set of wisdom, a certain set of experience, and we must take the baton, do our thing, and pass it on. We are part of passing the baton. And I think that when we commit and sacrifice towards things like this, more people will join in and they will see the point. And in all this, we must realize that this is God's earth, and we're only here for a short time, and that God will provide. And we must trust that when times get hard, that He will provide, and that He will give us a new identity. So, what I want to propose now, with this sermon being an introduction to starting to talk about these things and starting to talk about these themes of earth care within our community as a fundamental part of who we are as the Mercy House, I would like to propose for us a new land ethic. How are we going to treat things? What is our framework? What is our worldview? What is our understanding going to be of this place and who we are? So first, we must be founded in the assurance that the earth belongs to God. We must keep that in mind, and I've pounded on that a few times, but it is God's and not ours. We must operate in the culture and economy, not of autonomy, anxiety, or greed, but upon the subversive values of abundance, generosity, and neighborliness. We must seek to cut through the degrees of ambiguity of the current dominant culture, which at the same time will build a local economy. And that what happens locally has implications globally. Our land ethic must acknowledge both our immediate and indefinite needs as humans. However, the pursuit of our immediate needs must never damage the resources needed to provide for those needs in the future for ourselves, nor should it infringe on the pursuit of the needs of others. We must observe nature and mimic it as we go forward. We must not tinker too much with the way creation was set up. We should not stop from advancing technologically, but we must be extremely careful as we do so. We must ask ourselves the fundamental questions of with each new thing that comes along, and those things are, is this necessary? Will it really make my life better? Will it connect or disconnect me from the earth? We must acknowledge the interconnectivity of all things. We must recognize that we are in the middle of the story that God is telling. We are somewhere between the perfection of the Garden of Eden and the renewal of all things and the making of a new heaven and a new earth. That by being in the middle means that we are currently in a broken, dysfunctional society that upholds lies as truth. And we must find trust that God is shaping us into his people. We must acknowledge that there is work to be done, but we also need to relax and we need to rest. That there were laws originally set up, such as Sabbath, such as the year of Jubilee, such as not harvesting the corn of your field so that the poor can eat, and that every seventh year we take a break. Like, these are the rules. God is setting in place times for rest, and we must find that rest. In our society that is go, 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 we must stop, reflect, seek God, and relax, and then get back to work. We must not become nostalgic and hope for times that have long passed, but we must always be building for a future while taking lessons from our past as we move forward. We must recognize that our fate is bound with that of the earth, and that we are fully at fault for the apathetic view so far towards this earth, and that we are now fully responsible for its renewal with God. We must now come to cherish our land and our places that we call home. We must not, however, think that they are better than any other place, but we must just realize how special and important these places are to us. We must realize that there is a wisdom worked into the very fabric of all God's creation, and that there is rhyme and reason for all things. We must realize that a healthy earth equals a healthy humanity. And finally, we must recognize that the earth is the third dimension in the relationship between humans and God, and that the earth must be considered in all decisions that we make from now on. So it is our mission to reconcile ourselves back to earth. We must understand that the earth is God's, not ours. We must find our proper relation to God's earth. To do this, we must consider the land and everything that dwells in it. Not because we now have to, or because that it may be profitable, but because it brings us joy, and because it brings us pleasure, and it also brings those things to God. This, friends, is the coming of the kingdom of God. This is what it takes to go back to the garden. This is the making of a new heaven and a new earth. This is shalom. This is the reconciliation of humanity and earth. Amen. Are there any, I guess we could do like a discussion time. This is a lot. And you may not even agree with anything that I said. So I'd just like to open this up for a discussion and we can unpack this, talk this through. Anybody have anything that they want to say? I would recommend the Better World Shopping Guide. I think it's betterworldshopper.com. You can order a book. It rates all companies on what their impact with the earth is, and that way you can make more informed decisions. Better World Shopper. Okay. I just want to end in prayer, and I want to thank you for listening. This was entirely teaching-driven. It might not have been what you expected. So let's just pray together. God, we, as you, just want to consider the lilies. We want to consider all these things and observe them and take them in and let them give us joy as they give you joy. Peace.